Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasia Studies on the New Books Network. My name is Diana Dehanova, and I'll be your host today. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Elliot Borenstein, author of Plots Against Russia, Conspiracy and Fantasy After Socialism. Dr. Borenstein is professor of Russian and Slavic Studies, collegiate professor in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, acting chair of East Asian Studies, and senior academic convener for the Global Network at New York University. He's also the founder of the Jordan Center's All the Russias blog, where one of his current books in progress, Russia's Alien Nations, is currently being serialized. Plots Against Russia, which we'll be discussing today, was published just this year by Cornell University Press. The book is described as a study of paranoid, conspiratorial, and extremist trends in Russia's media, film, and fiction since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Elliot, thank you very much for speaking with us today. Now, in the preface to your book, you state the following, and I'm quoting, this is an uncomfortable book to write. It is also the book that I've been preparing to write my entire adult life, although there's no way I could have known it. Could you talk about what you meant there and how this book represents, if I understand correctly, the culmination of your scholarly work so far?
Sure. When I said that it was what I'd been working on my entire adult life, part of it was an acknowledgement that I have an attraction to fringe phenomena and to news of the weird and so on and so forth just in my own life. And so that, in fact, I try to develop a kind of healthy distrust of that instinct of my own when it comes to my scholarly work in Russia, because I get concerned that I'm just chasing after something very strange. But it is also the case that since I was in Moscow during the last couple of years of my graduate work, while writing my dissertation in 1992-1993, I was there at just the perfect time to start watching some of the most interesting phenomena of post-Soviet culture develop, which led to my second book. But along the way, I kept reading fringe newspapers, reading Dzień and then Zavtra, the extreme right-wing red-brown coalition newspapers from the 1990s, buying all of these very strange pamphlets and books and so on and so forth. And then eventually when stuff moved online, following these phenomena online and, of course, reading so much of the popular fiction that came out. And when I was working on my last book, Overkill, I had included a chapter called Plots Against Russia about conspiracy and paranoia, and was advised that it didn't really fit the book, which was fine with me. And I really didn't think I was going to be writing a conspiracy book for quite some time, largely because I was concerned that I might actually be distorting Russian reality or even Russia's media reality. But enough time passed, and sadly, I no longer had that concern.
Well, going off of that, you're very cautious from the very beginning of your book to avoid sort of simplistic or demonizing or orientalizing views of Russia, just what the study of the topics might suggest. And you describe it as the dangers of exoticizing the other. So can you talk a bit more about how your caution around this issue informs your work and especially your research in this book?
Sure. Well, for one thing, I'm always reminding myself, and I've gotten really into the mental habit of when I'm encountering a phenomenon, in this case related to conspiracy, that strikes me as particularly bizarre or hard to credit, I then go back and remind myself of something equally strange in my own native context here in the United States, to get in the habit of reminding myself that that strangeness and extreme thought and belief in things that one might think are impossible to believe in. These are hallmarks of most cultures. So I try to be very careful really about that. And then also to the extent that I can gauge how prominent a particular phenomenon or idea is. That's a problem because I don't really engage in that kind of empirical research, and I don't go looking for statistics and don't particularly trust statistics in general, and in Russia in particular. But I do try to keep in mind what's out there that's not strange and conspiratorial.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about your work really being more on the side of discourse, right, than what's actually happening, sort of documenting history.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like for the past 20 years or so, I practically started every talk saying I'm not talking about real life or real people. I'm not doing surveys. In a sense, the view, what I have is not really a bird's eye view. I have a kind of internet couch potato surfer eye view on things. That is, if you ask yourself what view you would get of a culture simply by consuming media and not necessarily by going outside and talking to people, that's the material that I'm looking at. And I'm aware that there's a whole world outside of the internet, apparently, but that's not a world that I'm actually studying.
Mm-hmm. And this connects to the process of assembling the research for this book, right? And the process that you're using now for your next book. And it started out as a blog. So can you talk a little bit about the development of the project and then how it took its present form?
Oh, sure. So the blog thing came about, it is really largely, even though it's a public-facing thing, and I like to think that some people are reading it, the blog thing is largely about setting up a device that disciplines me and makes me work. Because what I discovered when I started the All the Russias blog, one, was that I really, really liked doing it, and two, that this was a format that works very well for me and seems really natural for me and feels like the format that I should be working in all the time. Everything about all my approach to pretty much any set of work tasks or things I want to do is to break them down to small units and do a little bit of them at the time. That's how I read as well. And so once I started writing the blog, just on general Russian themes, it occurred to me that, you know, I spent so many years of my life not writing whatever book that I say I'm writing, that if I were to move to this sort of format, I would actually get a lot of work done, and I did. Also, I was hoping to get some publicity, of course, and to get feedback along the way, and I've gotten a little of that as well. But just as I was saying that I don't really know that my research isn't about what's going on in the world, but going on in the media, the corollary to that is I don't really know who's actually reading the blog. I know a few people. I don't know if it's only a handful of people, if it could be more. But for my own purposes of getting my own work done, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. That's a great approach, actually. I think maybe some of our early career academics and graduate students might copy you on that. So let's get into some of the key terminology here. So the first one, of course, is conspiracy and conspiratorial thinking. So how do you define it? And you're very careful to specify that conspiratorial thought lies on a spectrum.
Right? Yes, thank you. So that's a really complicated one because there is a large body of conspiracy scholarship going back, starting roughly around the post-World War II era. And it's large, but it's actually manageable to really read basically all of it. But what you see is a certain set of trends, a certain set of controversies that you really have to skirt around. And one of the big ones is the connection between conspiracy, and conspiracy here being, I would say, conspiracy is a bunch of people or entities working together to do something in secret and something that presumably is not something that you would want. People point out that that surprise parties are conspiracies, but no one calls them that because people don't tend to be upset by surprise parties. But the connection between conspiracy and paranoia, which I think is an easy one to make, because paranoia, of course, if you set aside its most extreme clinical version, paranoia is a tendency to overinterpret, to make too many connections, and to assume that nothing is random. That works very well with a conspiratorial mode of thought. But this really, the birth of all this, the primal scene of all of this is Richard Hofstadter's famous essay and book, On the Paranoid Style, a lecture he delivered on the day that Kennedy was shot, actually. And this essay, which is hugely influential, in fact, has gotten a real revival in the Trump age for, I think, obvious reasons, talks about how there is a paranoid style in politics, in American politics in particular, that that comes around rather cyclically. And understanding the paranoid style can help you understand what's going on with the politics. So this is an argument he made in Harper's originally, and it's an argument that is one of those arguments that immediately makes sense, I think, when you read it. And you don't need to be a scholar to follow it, read it, and see that it makes sense, which is exactly the sort of argument that the scholars then immediately want to take apart, in part because it looms so large, and in part because, quite rightly, I think, a lot of scholars felt that this connection between conspiracy and paranoia pathologizes people who believe in conspiracy theories, and basically defines them as essentially mentally ill. And I can certainly see why there's been so much of a hygienic impulse to separate the two. But for me, I argue that there's no reason to separate conspiracy and paranoia that carefully, as long as you realize that you are using the word paranoid, not in any way as a medical or psychiatric diagnosis, but in what I'm calling a mode or even a stance, a mode like irony, or really a point of view that you can have and don't have to have your entire life. I can go into that if you want, but that distinction between kind of a long-term paranoia and what I call the paranoid subject position is the theoretical contribution that I'm hoping other scholars of conspiracy end up noticing.
Yes, could you say a little bit more about that, the paranoid subject position?
Sure. So with this book, I start off, first of all, with a notion that everything, that our entire worlds, our worlds are constructed by narrative. We understand the world through narrative. It makes psychological sense to be constantly constructing narrative, because narrative is about taking a bunch of things that might not seem connected and seeing how they're connected so that everything is part of, you know, one big story. Paranoia certainly fits in with that quite well. And what I've done here is I followed, I don't want to stress this too much because I really believe in theory inflecting someone's thought rather than inflecting someone's writing so much. But I'm following a move that Derrida made when he was getting into an argument about Austin Speech Act theory, when he was arguing that you have to be able to imagine unserious speech acts in order to talk about serious speech acts. When I'm talking about a paranoid subject position and conspiracy, I argue that in fact it is fiction about paranoia and stories about conspiracy, that condition us to be able to imagine conspiracy as something that's really possible. So the very fact that you can watch an hour of, say, The X-Files, and for the course of that hour, suspend disbelief and live in a kind of epistemological mindset in which aliens are possible, conspiracies are possible, and then in the next hour you'll watch something else and that's not possible, suggests that we are always able to adopt a conspiratorial mindset when it's necessary or when it's useful or handy, and then dispose of it a minute later. So that there's no need to diagnose someone as paranoid. There's no need to see every manifestation of conspiratorial thought as a symptom of a complete conspiratorial worldview. That in fact we all adopt conspiratorial modes and drop them back and forth over the course of our day. And that's what makes it possible for some to believe in conspiracy in a much more committed fashion, in a much more sustainable fashion. But again, I think one of the mistakes that intellectuals make, and that people talk about that a lot lately, in particular when talking about politics, is thinking of everything in terms of rationality. And then when you see a breakdown of a kind of rational explanation, you show how something is not working. But actually, this is really a matter of affect, emotion, habits of thought, and the fact that you can be conspiratorial for a little while and not be conspiratorial right after that, to me, just seems very, very human and very discursive.
Mm-hmm. So what is it about post-Soviet Russia that makes the conspiratorial subject position one that is so often taken up?
Oh, that is a great question. And I would say that it's part of a longer process that that has made Russia / the Soviet Union of the past several decades a great hope for conspiracy theory. Again, as I'm saying that, not to suggest that other places are not. Certainly the United States is a great breeding ground of conspiracy theory, but I think coming out of different sources and for different reasons, at least initially. So in the post-war era, the post-Stalin era, I should say, and the Soviet Union, conspiratorial thought was enabled, I think, by the general the general lack of reliable information in the Soviet Union and the widespread assumption that you're not being told everything. And in fact, every time there is a revelation about some past crime that is finally doled out, instead of letting you know finally for the truth, it just reminds you of this other things being kept from you. So the restriction on information in late Soviet times facilitated conspiratorial thought. Then with Glasnost, with the opening up of the floodgates, that did a couple things. It reinforced the idea that there's information that's being held from you and there could still be more being held from you. And it also made actual conspiratorial tracts and novels and so on and so forth and films available for mass consumption. So that by the time you get to the post-Soviet era, you have these long-standing habits of conspiratorial thought, but you have it in an informational ecosystem that is almost, or at least until recently, almost the opposite of the one you had in late Soviet times, and much more like the informational ecosystem that facilitates conspiracy here in the United States. There's so much information out there, so many competing sources of information, and so many competing narratives that each one relativizes the other, and makes it possible to just pick and choose or assume that they're all wrong.
Now, there's two other terms that are important here to your structuring of conspiratorial mindset, and one is melodrama. So what role does melodrama play here?
So melodrama was actually something that was one of the first things I came up with back when this was part of the other book. Melodrama really came to my mind when I was thinking particularly of the novels and films that I was looking at where conspiracy takes place. Because the great thing about melodrama is, you know, when you think of melodrama, you think of, you know, big emotions and twists and turns of plot. But as a lot of scholars, including Peter Brooks in particular, and his melodramatic imagination argues, melodrama actually serves as this very useful and very schematic testing ground of ideas. And it is a way in which you can have good and evil fighting, and of course good is supposed to triumph, but what gets coded as good and what gets coded as evil, that's something that can depend on the cultural context, the author, and so on and so forth. And what I found was that the basic fictional conspiratorial plot, and even I would say beyond that, the kind of general political theoretical conspiratorial plot, is quite melodramatic because you have good guys and bad guys. The bad guys are so bad that they're telling you their bad ideas and they know they're bad because they're just reveling in them. And it's up to the good guys to save everybody from these bad guys. So it's incredibly schematic, and it's such a big part of our worldwide popular entertainment that it would make sense that this also can be compelling as a political thought through narrative.
And that feeds in very well into Russia's sort of, particularly in the last 10 years, its role, perceived role of a world leader, right? Of the vanguard of traditional values, for example.
Mm-hmm. So, and that, as you said, it is a quite recent one. But what that does is it's a variation on a longstanding conspiratorial nationalist trope, which is to see Russia as surrounded by enemies that want to destroy it. And the reason the enemies want to destroy Russia, those can really vary depending on who's seeing the enemies, who the enemies are supposed to be, what time this is all taking place in. And now the traditional values thing works on multiple levels. For one, it can actually serve as a way for Russia to find allies in the world, but it also can justify why Russia should reasonably perceive of itself as a target, and why people hate Russia so much.
Now, the other term here, and this leads into kind of the next concept, is you talk about framing the book in the lens of fantasy, right? That's in the title, to examine conspiracy thinking in contemporary Russia and frame your questions around contemporary historical narrative in terms of fantasy. So what role does fantasy play in understanding discourse around Russian history and identity today?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So some of that is a sort of larger claim that I'm trying to make through this book, but one that I don't think will be noticed outside of the small readership that this book is going to get, which is that we tend to think that people assume they live in a world that looks like the world of a realist novel, and that realism is the default both for our lives and for fiction, when in fact that is historically recent and not even necessarily accurate. A lot of people, depending on their religious worldviews, their beliefs in phenomena that we might call New Age or pagan or superstitious, the worlds that they are walking around in are not the worlds of realism. And I wanted to decenter realism in fiction by arguing that realism is just a version of fantasy that doesn't have magic in it. Because once you start representing the world around you in a text, in a narrative, you're just coming up with an approximation. And that approximation is a fantasy. It could have magic. If it doesn't have magic, then it allows people to believe that it might actually be more real. But with these ideological fictions that I'm looking at, some of which have magic and some of which don't, these are clearly fantasies, not so much in the immediately obviously in the way we think of, say, with epic fantasy, but fantasies and to an extent melodramas that take the world you see around them, rewrite that world in terms of a particular, often conspiratorial, ideological framework, and then try to convince you that what you're reading is not a fantasy, it's realism, and that in fact, this fantasy of what the world is actually what the world is, and by the end of reading the book, in a sense, you should be converted to the belief that this ideological fantasy is fact.
Mm-hmm. And that feeds into this idea of the imaginary country, right? You refer to Russia as an imaginary country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say every country is an imaginary country, and I'm not by any means original in talking about that. But part of this is, of course, yet another way out for me, in that just as I'm not talking about how people are really living their lives, when I'm talking about Russia, I'm much less talking about what is actually, you know, the economics of the country, the governmental structure, but it's the Russia that is being represented to itself through the mass media. And that is a Russia, just as an American imagination of America, that is always only going to approximate whatever is actually happening in what we would call the real world. And it is the imaginary Russia that is much more of a contested place when it comes to politics and ideology than in many cases the real Russia is, if we're not talking about, say, fights among, you know, oligarchs for money.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are some of the sort of, let's say, non-negotiable foundational or cultural myths that underpin the dominant historical narratives in Russia? And is it fair to say that Russophobia is kind of a unifying factor here?
Russophobia is absolutely the unifying factor. I mean, as a term, it only comes up in the 19th century and really becomes current starting in the last half of the previous century. But this notion of this irrational, reflexive hatred of Russia that is simply not going to go away, that is incredibly useful. It is also, I would say, flattering, because people are bothering to hate you. One of the things that I think is really remarkable, what's happened in the past couple of years, is this whole Russiagate stuff and all of that is really reassuring to the Russian Russian conspiratorial mindsets. Not only because it looks like conspiracy, but because we in the West are paying attention to Russia. What Russophobia presupposes is not only that everybody hates Russia, but that everybody thinks Russia is important enough to hate. And I think one of the most offensive things Obama said when it came to Russia was that it's not a world power. And I can see why he said that. There are many reasons why he would say that. But that is the sort of thing that if you think twice about, you don't say, because it's actually, in a sense, a challenge to prove that you are a world power. And so hostility towards a Russia that we think is a powerful enemy, is much more friendly than simply the benign neglect of Russia, or not so benign neglect of Russia, that has usually characterized the American media and political culture for huge chunks of time since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that the rise in conspiratorial thinking in Putin's third term is connected to this desire to reinforce Russia as a threat?
I think that Putin's regime's use of conspiratorial discourse is related to that. It's remarkable how much this stuff has gone from margin to center in the past several years. It was happening slowly over the first decade of the 21st century, but really dramatically kicked into high gear with Putin's reelection. Just as there is this emphasis on traditional values, the embracing of a conspiratorial worldview is hugely useful politically. For years, there'd been talk about the need for a national idea. Yeltsin had a committee that came up with nothing. Surkov came up with sovereign democracy, and conservatism seems to kind of fit it. But if you take together traditional values, the notion that Russia is under attack from all sides, that's not an idea, but it is enough. Those things are enough of a national story to be a unifying fantasy, or at least I think that's what the regime is hoping, and it does seem to work fairly well.
Now, in thinking about the roots of a lot of these conspiracies and sort of the key adversaries, right, anti-Semitism plays a really large role, particularly the source text of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, but of course it goes back much further. So could you talk a little bit about the role that anti-Semitism plays as well as its limitations in understanding Russian conspiratorial thinking?
Sure. So anti-Semitism is, of course, foundational to a lot of Western conspiratorial thought, going back in particular to the Protocols, which is, a wonderful Russian plagiarized contribution to world conspiratorial lore. But there are obvious reasons why Jews would be a group that would be particularly susceptible or particularly useful for this kind of narrative. That is, a group of people who can look sort of like you, but not entirely like you, a state within a state, a group of people who are not, who won't eat with you, won't eat the same foods as you, but are everywhere, so therefore don't have, local loyalties. I mean, all of this is really well established in the literature on anti-Semitism. And it is particularly Jews as boundary-crossing people, and of course connected with the institutions of modernity, that make them a great target for this kind of conspiratorial narrative, which is particularly well embodied and stupidly embodied in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is just so badly written. It's just lots of fun, if it weren't for the fact that it was so destructive. And what I see with that is that there are a couple things that go on. One is that maybe because the sort of master text of conspiracy for the 20th century and beyond is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the result is that structurally, a lot of conspiracies, if a conspiracy has an international enemy, even if it's not named the Jews, it is based on what it is homologous to the role the Jews play in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So it matters if it's Jews, but if it almost doesn't matter because whoever is the enemy in that structure basically is taking on the role of Jews. And what was fascinating to me in the 1990s was that there would be a lot of conspiratorial fiction that would use the structures of these old-fashioned conspiratorial narratives, often involving not calling things Masons, but groups that are kind of like the Masons. In particular, I'm thinking of the Bieshny Mad Dog series that I read to death in Overkill. For years, they're fighting this secret cabal that's not identified as Masons, not identified as Jews. And then after the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia, when the political culture turned on a dime and America became enemy number one, all of a sudden that secret cabal that had been in so many books was now the secret cabal of Jews and Masons. So you have a structure that doesn't have to be anti-Semitic, but could be filled with anti-Semitic content at just about any moment.
Now, let's talk about some of the common conspiracy theories that have been particularly influential that you mentioned. So you mentioned three, and we can just sort of do an overview. So there's the Harvard Project, the Dulles Plan, and the Houston Project.
Yeah. So the Harvard Project is my personal favorite. It's concocted by this emigre, Georgi Klimov, who had actually worked in the real Harvard Project, which was a study of Soviet emigres in the United States. It was basically a sociological survey. But what he turned it into in his political tracts and his novels, between which there's a very small difference, is this idea that Harvard, run by Jews, of course, and homosexuals, because Harvard Jews and homosexuals are basically all the same thing, are trying to have taken over Russia. They were behind the revolution. They're continuing to try to destroy Russia, and they're trying to do this on a genetic level by destroying the purity of Russian DNA. And so this idea, this is very, very fringe and wasn't published in the Soviet Union until the last years of the Soviet Union's existence, but it was the sort of thing that spread, by rumor mill for a bit, and then found its way onto the internet and also became a big component of this trilogy of conspiratorial novels at the end of the 1990s by this man named S. Norka. But the Harvard Project imagines that that the West, Jews, Harvard, are trying to destroy Russia. Then the Houston Project, which is imagined sometime in the 1990s by a bunch of different sources, largely on the internet, suggests that actually now that the Harvard Project has worked and destroyed the Soviet Union, the Houston Project, its successor, is going to destroy Russia. And it is focused largely on dismantling the Russian Federation and making lots of little statelets, and making Siberia available for a takeover by the West, both for the use of its natural resources and because it's a place where the one place in the world that's going to survive after global cataclysm. The Dulles Plan is the most famous of them. It's based entirely on a work of fiction, a monologue in this novel that became the basis of Vechny Zov, The Eternal Call, a very popular miniseries on Soviet television, with this monologue where a Nazi is explaining how he's going to undermine the Soviets by ruining their values and getting young people to like trash instead of high culture and to become immoral. This Nazi speech becomes the plan by Alan Dulles, of American spy and intelligence fame. This is just completely put in the mouth of Dulles, and the idea is that America is trying to ruin the Soviet Union and then Russia, but initially the Soviet Union, by getting young people to, you know, listen to rock and roll and buy blue jeans and so on and so forth, and turn their backs on the truths of their fathers. So what is great about the Dulles Plan, and the Harvard Plan too, but particularly about the Dulles Plan, is that it takes conspiracy, anti-Russian conspiracy, and sees it primarily in the realm of information and culture, and therefore as a project of a kind of brainwashing that the West is trying to do on the Soviet Union / Russia. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned the issue of homosexuality and Judaism all sort of being like one giant boogeyman. So I wanted to transition to the idea of gender ideology featuring so prominently in conspiracy thinking. So can you talk a bit about why is homosexuality understood as an attack on Russian culture and values, and how it's used to sort of frame this inimical relationship with the mm-hmm. West?
I mean, the short answer is actually now homosexuality and Judaism a lot of the conspiratorial world are not the same thing, and in terms of structural homologies, the LGBT people are in a sense the new Jews as the new internal enemies. excuse me. Now the question is, you know, why and why now, right? Because it's not as if there's a great recent history of Soviet or Russian love and embracing of LGBT people. In Soviet times, of course, a male homosexuality is criminalized, and lesbianism, if it was noticed, was could lead to women being sent to mental hospitals. But in the early 1990s, all of that was decriminalized, and for a good 10 years, you had a period when, again, it wasn't like Russian mass media or Russian people you'd speak to were brimming with love for LGBT people, far from it. But there wasn't a concerted campaign against LGBT people, and there was room to talk about how queer people could be people like anyone else, and people deserving of rights, and people that you might know. There was a lot of cynicism about any public figure who came out as gay, that they're probably just doing it to get publicity, you know, like Tatu, the girl group. But really, it wasn't a matter of a great deal of venom. So for this to change in the 21st century, arguably this took efforts by some groups of people. The irony here is, as I start to talk about efforts by groups of people, I sound like I'm talking about a conspiracy. And I'm aware of this because structurally, a lot of what happens looks sort of like a conspiracy. For one thing, it is pretty well known, and I see more and more writing about this really every week, that the American right-wing evangelical organizations have been very active around the world in promoting anti-LGBT legislation and promoting just a kind of general hostility to anything that doesn't look like their notion of the traditional family. They've certainly been very, very active in funding the anti-abortion movement and so on and so forth. So just as in Uganda and other places in Africa, but also in Central Europe and in Russia, there's been a lot of money and a lot of exchange of ideas and a lot of joint conferences by these sort of groups. So that's helped. Then there is the rise of a
particular kind of political and politicized Russian Orthodoxy. Not all of Russian Orthodoxy, of course, but one that, but a view of it that sees that Russian Orthodoxy should be a part of political life, public life, and that people should be living their lives, and the legislation should be matching the views on the family in the Russian Orthodox Church. And this is also a way for some politicians to get themselves known. So what happens is you start to see legislation against so-called gay propaganda happening in cities and regions, and eventually gets taken up in the Duma. And the hostility to LGBT people becomes the latest version, the latest useful thing to be co-opted into this narrative of Western hegemony, because when people from the West keep talking about marriage equality and LGBT rights, it's very easy to frame this as something alien, something being imposed on Russia. Russia supposedly, according to these people, doesn't have traditions of homosexuality. It's being brought in, and this fits in so well with all these other established conspiracy theories that basically you end up with this idea, in a sense, that the West is trying to make Russia gay. And then you have all of this incredible paranoia just about the rainbow symbol, which is just really funny because there have always been rainbow symbols. Rainbows are pretty and kids like rainbows. But now there's like this hunt for rainbow symbolism that could be trying to turn your children gay.
Yeah, that part of your book really reminded me of during the World Cup when people were taking undercover rainbow pictures that nobody would notice were rainbow until they were posted online. Yeah. So in terms of the idea that Russia or America is trying to make Russia gay, there's also this critique of liberalism, right? That over in America or in the West, they have this liberal approach to politics that then creates these really harmful social trends. So can you talk a little bit more about this critique or fear of liberalism, and particularly how it's used by the current administration?
Sure. So the fate of liberalism in Russia has some parallels with what's happened and been happening with liberalism in the United States and Western Europe, but it developed at a different pace and for somewhat different reasons. So at the end of Perestroika in the 1990s, you have a regime, Yeltsin's regime, and a set of reforms that are identified as liberal. And as we know, liberal can mean two things that don't have to, at least two things that don't have to have very much to do with each other. One is liberalism is economic policy, which is actually more like, the Washington consensus or neoliberalism. It's Thatcher and Reagan. And it's not a liberalism that's about procedural democracy or about equality of rights. That liberalism also appears at the same time, but there's no reason to expect anyone to, any average or even very well-educated person who's learning, who's being exposed to both these things at the same time, to be able to distinguish between the two. And neither of them is possible. Neither of them is popular. Economic liberalism led to the destitution of a huge portion of the population. So obviously that's not going to be looked upon very well. And then at the same time, you have suddenly this attention being paid to people like LGBT people for whom a lot of people wouldn't even think of as like something to be concerned about. And this change in values that really disturbs people. So you end up with this kind of liberal bogeyman that is bad on just about every front. So everything about the 1990s becomes associated with liberalism, whatever liberalism means. And one of the things that Putin and people around him did extremely successfully as they're showing why Putin is good and why this particular system is better than the one before it, they use the 1990s as a reminder of how bad things can get and how bad things will be if you don't let the leaders do what they're doing, because the liberals will come back and they will ruin our culture and they'll ruin our economy. So liberalism is a really easy target, and I think it's going to be very hard for anyone calling themselves a liberal really to make any kind of political success in Russia in the foreseeable future.
So to shift from the sort of the consumed, right, the media of conspiracy to the consumer, one of the key aspects you talk about is this uncritical view of the media as a producer of like a passively consumed product. You describe this as a zombified subject who's unwittingly mobilized through media messaging. So why is this construct important in conspiracy theory, and why, according to your analysis, is it an inaccurate way of understanding media consumption?
Sure. Well, it is a pretty common feature of a lot of conspiratorial worldviews in the past several decades, that is since the rise of the mass media, to see in the mass media as the vehicle for controlling people, right? Whether it's whether it's a matter of people being afraid that some sort of electromagnetic waves are controlling their brains and they have to wear the tinfoil hats that we think of, you know, when we're talking about extreme conspiracy theorists. There is, I think, part of it you could see as a kind of reaction to the sort of networked world in which we live, that the autonomous subject is really harder and harder to give credit to, and that we're all influenced, and there are all these inputs, and so maybe something is undermining us, whether it's, you know, something like, whether it's fluoride in the water or subliminal messages in a movie. All of these things could be imagined to be ruining us. And in the West, in particular, as media criticism developed, the initial approach to media was a propaganda model. That the assumption is, and I'm not even getting to Russia yet, but the assumption is that we watch TV, we listen to the radio, watch some music, and we are basically like this giant orifice. Everything comes in, we have no control of whatever it is, and we receive the messages that are given to us. This is the media effect school. This is the hypodermic model of media influence. It's been out of favor among media scholars for the past 50 years or more. And the most productive work I've seen in media criticism, again, in the past 50 years, tends to talk about the ways in which people misunderstand, either deliberately or accidentally, misunderstand the messages that get to them, reappropriate the stories, and make them something of their own. That, in fact, you can't assume that the messages are getting through as they're meant to, so that the consumer of media is always constructing meaning that may or may not coincide well or not at all with the intents of the people making the media. However, when you do have media, in particular news media, where you can see the bias really, really easily, and I'm not, and this is not to argue that there's some sort of wonderful platonic news media out there that has no bias, but there are media outlets that are just so much more obviously slanted than ones that are not. One could argue that that a media slant that is hidden might actually be more pernicious. But the point is, if you know, if you have evidence, if you can see that stories are being slanted, that a particular point of view is being put through the media, then you can assume this is what's happening all the time. And if you, and the zombification thing, and zombification is really just the Russian metaphor that serves the same function as our metaphor of brainwashing. The zombification metaphor tends to assume not that you get zombified or that I get zombified by the media, because I'm smart enough to know that the media have an influence and I can ward it off somehow. But the people you disapprove of, the people you disapprove of, the people who are wrong, part of the reason they're wrong is that they are brainwashed or zombified by some media influence or some foreign influence that you think is evil or pernicious. And this is what comes out most clearly in the conflict in Ukraine, where on Russian state television, they'll talk about people in Ukraine being zombified by the Ukrainian media. And on Ukrainian state television, they'll talk about people in Russia being zombified by the Russian state media. And of course, the irony is that just the moment you have a media outlet bringing up the possibility of media zombifying you, all you have to do is take one step back and think, well, this is what this media outlet could be doing too. But the great thing about the zombification metaphor is how actually it usually doesn't work that way, and it allows you to dismiss someone else's views, but see yourself as somehow immune.
Actually, in this discussion of Ukraine dovetails into another term that you present and critique, which is information war. And so what is meant by information war specifically in this situation between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, information war, the idea behind information war, both in Ukraine and Russia, and also when we're talking about the United States and Russia, is basically to assume that information is being weaponized, right? That information is being selected and carefully massaged, not just to tell you something that's not true, but to get you to take on a view or to do something that you would not do otherwise. So the assumption, this is like the next step in a kind of paranoid approach to your media inputs, that someone out there, either someone out there is doing this, or you can do this to the other side, which is to change rearrange the furniture in their heads, right? By broadcasting at them a certain set of information that will produce a particular reaction.
Now, in the conclusion to your book, you briefly discuss, of course, current Russian-American relations and the impact of the Trump presidency on Russian conspiratorial thinking. Could you comment on that a little bit and how it influences perceptions of Russian-American relations among sort of the populace as well?
Yeah, this is one thing that was either really unfortunate or in a grim way fortunate for me as I was writing this book, that this became way too relevant. In a way that I had never imagined, but I have a very limited imagination when it comes to the actual things that end up actually happening. So as the whole Trump-Russia story started to develop, that was one of the things that made me very aware of how vulnerable we all are when it comes to positioning ourselves in terms of competing media narratives. If I could shift for a moment to Ukraine again, to the downing of the Malaysian airliner. That will get me back to Trump, I promise. But when it came right down to it, I mean, I believe that it was a bunch of Russian-supported Ukrainian idiots who shot down the wrong plane. All the initial social media stuff, everything totally made sense. I must admit that fits into my worldview, which sees accident and contingency is much more important than planning, and made more sense than any other narrative. But when it comes right down to it, and it's a matter of, say, the Dutch report on what happened versus the Russian report on what happened, I'm not reading either of them. I'm not in any position to challenge the aeronautics explanations about any of these. And that what I realize happens is, you know, to use the Jewish expression, I've picked my rabbi, right? There's a set of media sources that I trust more, that also tend to align more with the way I see the world, and so I find them more credible. I don't find the Russian state explanations credible, but this does not really give me any kind of external positivist perfect way of adjudicating anything. So then Trump-Russia comes along, right? And, you know, for once, you and I were all, everybody actually wants to hear what we think, which is kind of amazing. Like, who cares what we think about anything? Suddenly, after the first time in years, people care what we think. And the funny thing is, my reaction is like, how the hell should I know if Trump was colluding with Russia, right? I mean, I don't have access to any information that anyone else has, any more information than anyone else has. I'm not getting briefed. I'm not seeing secret documents. All I can do is imagine, is think about what makes sense based on what I know of Russia, what I know of the United States, what I imagine I know of Donald Trump, and come to some tentative conclusions. But once again, really, this is I think what makes, one of the things that makes conspiracy not only appealing but almost impossible to fight, is that, you know, if someone, let's say I'm talking to someone who has a hardcore believer that, you know, Trump has been a Russian asset since 1980, whatever, that always seemed extreme to me. I could make some arguments why I think that's probably not the case, but really we're all just talking about stuff we don't really know. So with Trump Russia, for a long time I've really felt that it starts and finishes with what you already believe, and that still continues even after the non-release of the Mueller report, right? And this is sort of a classic Soviet-style moment of having this lack of information. Everybody's projecting a great deal on this almost 400-page document that we're not allowed to read. And so, of course, we're all kind of paranoid, and of course we're seeing conspiracies. And in fact, you know, if you look at the non-release of the Mueller report and the four-page write-up by a guy who already said that the president couldn't possibly commit a crime while he's in office, this sure looks a lot like conspiracy.
Yeah, so it certainly goes to show that we are no less susceptible to these constructs than anyone on the other side. So before we wrap up, could you tell us a bit about your current and upcoming projects?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I would love to, because I'm much more interested in them than I am in this book now. So the book I'm writing now, actually the series of books I'm writing now, is the one that I thought I was writing before I started writing Plots Against Russia. It's now looking like it's, believe it or not, going to be a trilogy, a three-book series. Each with the title Russia's Alienation, and then a different subtitle after that. They're all explorations of a kind of sense of imagined identity and self after the collapse of socialism. So what I'm working on, what I'm serializing now, I'm just finishing up chapter one after doing the introduction, is the volume is called Russia's Alienations, Imagining the Other After Socialism, and it's exploring different identities that pop up and are either assumed or projected onto some other internal Russian other that you might not like, that then serve a function of defining a sense of Russia from the 1990s on. So the first chapter is on Savuk, you know, this notion of this kind of Soviet hick. The next chapter is on the new Russian. Then there's a chapter on this weird online phenomenon of people identifying Russians with orcs. And then there's going to be something about transnational adoption. The second volume is going to involve time travel and alternate history. And the third volume is going to involve what I call Soviet melancholy and discourses of Russianness as Russianness travels from place to place.
Mm-hmm. That sounds fascinating. And your work is absolutely a gift to those of us who teach Russian media because students absolutely love it.
Oh, thank you.
And where finally can our listeners find you on social media?
On social media, so I'm most active on Facebook, where you just look up my name, but my Facebook mm-hmm. feeds into my Twitter, which I really largely neglect. It's just sort of automatic there. But on Twitter at Elliot B, that's ELIOTB 2002, which is also one of my email addresses, and I'm on Facebook as Elliot Borenstein. That's basically how you find me. No Instagram.
Okay, fantastic. Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Elliot Borenstein, author of Plots Against Russia, Conspiracy and Fantasy After Socialism, now available via Cornell University Press. Elliot, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Diana.